So we thought we would give you more to think about in terms of justice and peace. So up here you have first order, second order, third order. Huh? So we can get a nice rounded picture of justice and peace. And I'm going to allow these good people to introduce themselves in sharing how they live out their particular rule of life and how justice and peace operates in their lives. We'll hear from the three panelists, then we'll take a little break, and then we'll come back and have some Q&A and some discussion. Some dialogue. Remember dialogue? So as the panelists are sharing with you, just keep in mind anything that you'd like to help, anything you'd like help with enlivening your journey in terms of justice and peace. And remember, it's not just the appointed JPEG animators in your fraternity. It's the entire fraternity that does justice and peace. Formation, the ministers, the treasurers, everyone, even the inquirers and the candidates. Because remember, peace begins within. If you have that war waging within, you cannot do peace and justice without. So we'll begin with our second order, Sister Bernadette Marie.
They're beginning with me because I'm the shortest. Not because of the second order. Now, you know, I always begin with a joke or a story or something like that. I'm not going to do that today. Oh. Okay. Just a few things. There are 25 things about God, but I'm only going to give you 5. And if there's time, after, you know, to get you back here for the break, I'll give you some more. Okay? Give God what's right, not what's left. Man's way leads to a hopeless end. God's way leads to an endless hope. A lot of kneeling will keep you in good standing. Exercise daily, walk with the Lord. And the fifth one, never give the devil a ride. He will always want to drive. You know, before I came here, one of our sisters went to, she's a Federation president, and she was visiting the houses up in the north, and she came home with 13 bags, gift bags. And so she gave us all a number, and she said, so when your number was called, you went up and just picked a gift bag, and all the gifts in the bag were from another community, another Port Clair community. Their abbess told them to go in their room and find something that they could wrap up and give to the sisters in Traveler's Rest. So it was interesting. So my number was number 6, so I like butterflies. I went up to pick up the butterfly bag, and in the butterfly bag was this book on peace by Gandhi. And I thought, God speaks in many ways. And each sister received something that was related to her in some way. It was just amazing how God works. Okay, I'd like to begin my sharing this afternoon with another story. I love stories, you know. This morning or last night, Father Linus talked about the wolf, Gubbio, and then Caroline talked about the story, the Cherokee story about the two wolves. Well, mine is about two angels. Okay. Two traveling angels stopped to spend the night in the home of a wealthy family. The family was rude and refused to let the angels stay in the mansion's guest room. Instead, the angels were given a small space in the cold basement. As they made their bed on the hard floor, the older angel saw a hole in the wall and repaired it. When the younger angel asked why, the older angel replied, "Things aren't always what they seem." The next day, the pair came to rest at the house of a very poor but very hospitable farmer and his wife. After sharing what little food they had, the couple let the angels sleep in their bed where they could have a good night's rest. When the sun came up the next morning, the angels found the farmer and his wife in tears. Their only cow, whose milk had been their sole income, lay dead in the field. The younger angel was infuriated and asked the older angel, "How could you let this happen? The first man had everything, yet you helped him," she accused. "The second family had little, but was willing to share everything, and you let the cow die." "Things aren't always what they seem," the older angel replied. "When we stayed in the basement of the mansion, I noticed there was gold stored in the hole in the wall. Since the owner was so obsessed with his greed and unwilling to share his good fortune, I sealed the wall so he couldn't find it." Then last night, as we slept in the farmer's bed, the angel of death came for his wife. I gave him the cow instead. Things aren't always what they seem. And I'm going to continue with that in a minute, but before I do that, I know this is a terrible time for us to give a talk right after lunch that we rushed through. So, just in case, and I'm really looking at Father Louis, just in case you fall asleep, I have a little bell that I'm going to ring. It's so, you won't miss anything, okay? Now, if I see some heads nodding, I'll wait until I see Louise before I ring the bell. Okay. Now, the story of the angels, things aren't always as they seem. Many would think, I think many of you might think this, in a monastery, it's very peaceful and quiet. All the sisters get along with each other. You may have this sense because when you meet the sisters, they are happy. But things aren't always as they seem. They aren't always peaceful. As you know, the fraternity and community are core values for followers of Francis and Claire. But let me describe how each are different. In a fraternity, individuals relate primarily to other individuals. It is these individualized relationships which bind the group together. It is the interaction of member to member that eventually unites the whole group into a fraternity of mutually related brothers and sisters. An image that Sister Marie Bea used in describing this is that of a circle of persons, each holding the hand of one next to him or her, and so forming a circle. Life energy moves around the circle as members deepen their relationship with each other, and it is this renewal of spirit and life that makes fraternity such a rich resource for energizing ministry. Do you agree? Yes. Okay. In the community, on the other hand, each member relates primarily to the whole, and the total community relates to the individual. Members entrust themselves to the community, working to maintain and strengthen it, responding to its needs in love. Communal faith and shared values bond the group in growing openness. Life together is their ministry. But in Claire's contemplative community, the members are always together, 24/7. Sharing life in community is the sisters' ministry. Community holds priority. Life together is the challenge of the apostolate. There is no escape from the demands of relating within community. None of the excitement of new beginnings, nor the hope that difficult situations will be resolved by a change of personnel. You know, I lived in an apostolic community for 34 years before I became a poor Claire. And it was easy. You got up in the morning, you saw the sister, you went to work, you came home in the evening, you saw the sister, you did your work, and you went to bed. Not so in a contemplative community. And in my other community, I loved children, so I was a teaching sister. So you basically just saw the sisters in the morning and in the afternoon, and sometimes in the evening. But sometimes you had meetings in the evening, so you didn't even see them then. But in the sisters in a contemplative community, either you relate to each other in the truth and love of Jesus, or your life will be reduced to perpetual imprisonment. Now, it doesn't really happen that way, but at times, I'll tell you, it feels that way. Despite such obvious difficulties, close community always promises special joys. I'm sure my community is rejoicing I'm here and not there. The opportunity to grow in unity of mind and heart that such constant living together makes possible. The support of shared belief that this hidden intercession makes a difference. Now, St. Claire wrote her rule after experiencing community with 50 sisters. She experienced that community for 40 years before she wrote her rule. She was the first woman to ever write a rule. Other communities were given a rule by men. They didn't know anything about women living together. As the case with the Benedictines, although the Benedictines have a good rule too. So Claire wrote out of her experience. Now this is what she says in chapter 10. In fact, I admonish and exhort the sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ to beware of all pride, vainglory, envy, avarice, care and anxiety about this world, detraction and murmuring, dissension and division. Let them always be eager to preserve among themselves the unity of mutual love, which is the bond of perfection. 40 years experience. Why did she include words like murmuring, dissension, division? It's because she experienced these with 50 women. They were human women. You know, and when I first read that in the rule, I thought, this is a good community to be in. Because this rule is really written about what is true, what is right. They're human. They act like human people, all of us. So these women, but you know, one of the big things is these women were from many different classes in those days. St. Clair was from the nobility. Now, my brother friars don't want to admit this, but she was a lot smarter than Frances. Okay, some of the other women were from Frances' class, the middle class, the merchant class, and yet others were from the poorer class. And some were not even educated at all. That was the poorer class. They couldn't read or they couldn't write. But St. Clair treated them equally and expected all to live the same rule. Even her mother was in her rule. It was in her monastery. But it was obvious this could have caused dissension and division. And so there wasn't always peace among the sisters at all times. But Claire continues. She knows what's happening in her community. So she continues, let those who do not know how to read not be eager to learn. Claire doesn't think that was important. Let them rather devote themselves to what they desire to have above all else, the Spirit of the Lord and his holy manner of working, to pray always to Jesus with a pure heart and to have humility, patience in difficulty and infirmity, and to love those who persecute, blame, and accuse us. For the Lord says, blessed are those who suffer persecution for the sake of justice, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So the goal of the sisters' efforts, and our goal, is to preserve the unity of mutual love and peace. And Claire does give some practical examples in her rule. Whatever concerns the group as a whole is to be decided by the group as a whole. Can you imagine getting 50 women together to agree on something as a whole? No, we can't even do it with 13. This can be seen as giving the sisters a voice regarding the persons who are to be received in the community. And we still do this today, sharing with the sisters the good news about donations even received, also about the work assignments of each sister. Now we're going through the work assignments, and everybody's wondering, who's going to get what in that place? Who's going to get that charge, you know? And sometimes I ask one of the sisters, do you know who's going to get such and such? No, I don't. She really does. She doesn't want me to know it yet. That's all I think. But Claire warns, she also warns against the climate of anger settling in, chilling relationships and hardening of hearts. And she writes, the abbess and her sisters, however, must beware not to become angry or disturbed on account of anyone's sin, for anger and disturbance prevent charity in oneself and in others. But she's not speaking of the flash of anger that just comes. But she's speaking about the anger that is nurtured through this emotion, through critical judgment, gossip, resentment, and revenge. It's so easy. Do you know what so-and-so just did? You know, that's easy, and it's kind of common, too. All these damage the peace so essential to live in a contemplative life. If a sister offends another, the rule restates the gospel injunction, which you've heard before, a mutually responsibility both to seek and receive pardon, so that what begins as negative ends up in strengthening the bond of charity. Well, it's the same today. As I said, my community is composed of 13 women who come from different states, different backgrounds, different education, and different upbringing. Of course, we do have one thing in common, and that is the fact that the same Lord has called us together. But how do we work for that peace that the Lord calls to us and the peace and justice we are to share with others? How do we deal with our differences in order to maintain a peace within ourselves as well as in community? Well, we've decided to do some things to help us to get to know each other and understand each other. We are engaged in a process called human formation, transforming and cultivating the human heart. And we've been doing this every month. But what it's a long title, but what it means is really sharing your background, sharing why you do what you do. And it helps when we meet each month to discuss this. It's been really revealing. Oh, that's why she does that, you know, and trying to understand one another. I'm going to give you an example of this, what I mean. Sister X and I were eating a meal together when she said to me, are you starving? And I said, no, but I was hungry. Why do you ask? I said to her. Well, you cleaned your plate and left nothing on it. I said, yes, but you have some food on your plate. She said, yes, I was told always to leave food on my plate so that people wouldn't think I was starving. Oh, I said, I was always told to clean my plate to show that I was grateful for the food that I was given. I also was told not to waste food. But you know, a little secret, in my Italian family, we had to eat a bowl of pasta before we went out to eat, so we wouldn't appear to be starving and wonder when somebody's going to feed us. But you see, that's really a small, insignificant example, but it differs, you know, from both of us. And so we talked about it. Well, in a contemplative community, these little things become big and bigger and cause gossip. So we are learning about each other, and that helps us to understand each other and have a more peaceful environment. There was a sister that rarely shared about herself, really, her background. And then doing this human formation thing, it came out that her mother said, "Don't ever tell anyone what we do in this house." And so she kept it, and boy, that was really an eye-opener. We thought she just didn't want to communicate to us. The other nice thing that we do on Sunday with the Sunday Gospel each Friday evening, it helps that we share on the Gospel for the Sunday. And when the sister shares, what we're finding out is another level of faith. We find out how God is revealing himself to her. We find out what God means to this sister and how God acts in her life and how the Spirit is moving. So that's a very fruitful exchange and a very simple exchange to do, to share the scriptures. You know, Claire was a woman of peace, and twice she used the Blessed Sacrament to keep the Saracens from coming into the monastery and also attacking Sisi. So we pray as a community for peace in our world. We're aware of this through TV, newspapers, internet, and so we know what's happening all over the world. It's really neat because we talk only at lunchtime. Well, you know what happens in between lunchtimes. I mean, before lunch or dinner at noon, we have that little bit of talking that goes on that's probably not from the angel. And anyways, but you know, I know the sisters who have listened to the news. I know those sisters who have read the newspapers. So we can sit at any table. We have three tables. We can sit at any table we want. And I kind of gravitate to that table because I know she's going to keep me up on the news. But anyways, what we do, we mingle so that we share with everyone. And one of the emails that Carolyn sent me, she quoted at the bottom of the page, and I think you did this on purpose, maybe. Peace begins with each one of us, as she has spoken about today. It's a process of repeatedly showing mercy to ourselves, forgiving ourselves, befriending ourselves, accepting ourselves, and loving ourselves. As we learn to appreciate ourselves and accept God's gift of peace, we can begin to radiate peace and love to others. And for this for me means becoming aware of God's presence within us, within me. Carolyn spoke this morning on living mindfully. When she was saying that, I was thinking that for me is to be aware of the presence of Christ. You know, and if I go and approach my sisters and think before I speak, that's that little bit of silence, and think Jesus is in her. Maybe I can listen with better ears and not use my mouth so quick. In January of 2012, Claire Dorilia, she's a Glenriddle sister, came to our monastery and gave a workshop. She talked about what is beyond the stretch of love, of our love. Something in ourselves or something about another that may annoy us, something happens when we interact with them, or maybe even think of them. It goes, boy, your mind can do wonders, but it also can do destroying things, thinking of something. We know then there's something unfinished in us. Our abbess, who gives a reflection on Palm Sunday as we begin Holy Week, said, "Of course we know that if we can't go beyond the stretch of love for ourselves, we'll never be able to do so with others." Then Sister Mary challenged us by presenting questions for reflection, which I believe will bring more peace in ourselves and our community. And I'm coming to a close, and you guys are still having your eyes open. It's like an examination of conscience. Now you can close your eyes. But before you do so, on Friday was the feast day of our abbess. And as I was preparing this talk, I took these questions. They always ask me to make a card. I love making cards. So I took each of these questions and put them on a a piece of paper, and I gave that paper to each sister with a different question. You should have seen their eyes open. Wait till you hear the questions. But I did tell them that they didn't have to answer the question to the abbess. Just write on the back of it, Happy Feast. Okay? But these are the questions. Or some of them, not all of them, some. Are we able to reach out to the weak and vulnerable in our community? The weak and vulnerable are each of us. Am I willing to assume the goodness of each sister, even when I experience her poverty and vulnerability in ways that are uncomfortable for me? Do I accept that God's Spirit is working in and through each of us in diverse ways, but for a common unity? Am I able to overlook the little and big slights that happen in close community living and accept my sister when she disagrees with me, using a tone of voice that I hear is less than loving? Am I committed to speaking encouragement and gratitude whenever I find it? Do I try to find it? Am I willing to allow each sister to grow and my relationship with her to grow? Or am I limited by past experiences and expectations? Will I let go of wounds from the past, words from last year or years ago? You know, you lose your memory, but you sure don't lose those. Do I offer and receive the gift of gospel forgiveness? Am I willing to struggle with this when it doesn't come easily? What is still beyond my stretch of love and living together in community? And you could, let me finish, I have two more. Do we see the connection between the poverty we profess and how we live it, and the poor and inequality in our world? Are we blind to our participation in injustice and prejudices that disturb the peace of our neighborhood, our country, and our world? Lord, help us to see. You could take those questions in your fraternity and look at them too. But these are only some of the questions Mary presented. And she concluded, and I will conclude, with her prayer. May we kiss our own wounds, the wounds of each other, the wounds of our world, and ask that Easter peace come to our hearts and to the hearts of all God's children. Peace is a gift, but also something we must work toward and for in the world and in the lives of all people. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm a newcomer here. I've not been to your gatherings before. I'm David, and I'm with the fraternity in Athens, South Carolina, or Georgia, excuse me. I've been in South Carolina with the fraternity in Greenville. That's why I'm getting confused. About myself, I've been ordained quite a while, and I've been transferred 18 times, and that is a very suspect kind of thing. I still remember someone who commenting on Paul Harvey, who always advertised himself as well-traveled, and this professor said, well, any bum is well-traveled. So you can be suspicious of this bum. Anyway. I restarted on this last evening, and so I'm kind of shaky. But looking at the title that was given us, Animating Peace, of it being a rule of life. And I got to thinking that, in my mind, the way I can come to more peace with others is to hang with people who are peacemakers or give me a newer, a fuller dimension of things that I don't understand. People, therefore, who image in my mind peace with this or peace with that, I'd call them wisdom people, or getting to connect with people who I don't understand necessarily, but they will lead me to a place of peace in relationship to them because now I understand them, and so on and so forth. So for me, relationships are a way to peace. There's just no doubt about it. I think about Jesus, who was able to go just about anywhere because he had he understood who he was. He had an identity. Therefore, he was not afraid to go among Gentiles and people of sinners and anywhere else, tax collectors, anybody. He would sit and eat with them, etc. Why? Because I think he had a strong identity of who I am. Well, I know he had a strong identity of who he am. And I think about St. Francis, for instance. You know, here there were the Crusades. We're going to get rid of the Muslims and recapture the holy places. And so we go with guns and knives and all of the other things. Francis just wanted to go and get to know them and meet them and maybe we'll relate to each other and so on. So he becomes a real inspiration for me and I hope for us about crossing borders, immersing ourselves in other situations. As Carolyn said this morning, praying is fine, but we've got to do more than pray for peace or whatever objective we have. We've got to also somehow change ourselves, act on what we do. I was thinking about, remember the Bosnian, Macedonia, Croatia conflict and Slobodan Milosevic? And I still remember we went to Father Joe Nangle, which one or the other of you might know, and said, because at the time I think I was working in the Justice and Peace Department there in our province, and I said, why don't we go and talk to that man and see if we, and I think we did send some kind of petition to Clinton at the time, I believe it was the Clinton administration, saying, instead of all of this fighting, why can't we first sit down and see if we can't work out our differences and understand and listen to one another? And that goes on and on. I with Osama bin Laden, I thought about the same thing many, many times. Why isn't anybody trying at least? And I know that is pie in the sky. That's David the idealist talking about these things. But if we don't hang with one another, we don't understand one another, and we aren't necessarily at peace with one another. So I think a good question for us is to ask ourselves, where is the Lord showing me that I ought to go and make peace, or I ought to understand this society or this individual or whatever better? You know, it can be in any kind of department. It can be groups. It can be organizations. It can be the undocumented. It can be a whole lot of... Why do we have this conflicted issue about the undocumented? I think a lot of it is because we haven't listened to both sides. We hear one side, but we don't hear the other side. Here's someone who, for me, has made peace with the environment, and that's Sister Miriam Therese McGillis, Dominican sister. She heads up Genesis Farm in New Jersey. And I listened to her talk one time. She talked for 5 hours without referring to a note. But her whole objective is to implement Father Thomas Berry's what does he call himself? A geologian, I think he called himself. And He was one of our great environmentalists. One of them living today is Barry Lopez. But Sister Miriam Therese McGillis tries to implement the theology and the teaching of Father Thomas Barry. And so she started this farm in western New Jersey. And her whole thing is to respect the earth, not try to introduce things that are not native to this territory, to the water that is here or not here, to the trees and the plants that grow here, and so on and so forth. In other words, she's trying to get us to respect the earth rather than violate the earth. She's trying to get us to make peace with the earth, the environment, rather than destroy it and make it do things that we might want it to do, but it isn't made to do. And I still remember her saying, you know, among other things, because she also talks about a very simple lifestyle. And she said, you know, none of us are going to do this kind of thing, live more simply, for instance, and be less a consumerist society unless it is attractive to us, unless we are excited about doing it. She said, nobody's going to do it just because you tell them they got to do it. She said, it's got to be something that you own and are excited about and want to do. And when you do it, you are somehow renewed, refreshed. You go on. You can live with less and still be happy, that kind of thing. So, you know, whatever it is, again, the idea of hanging with people and arriving at a sense of peace with them. I've done, if you read my little bio, that on a side, I've done quite a bit of prison ministry in my life. And, you know, prisons I knew nothing about, knew no prisoners. But once I went in and so on, I suddenly realized these are, as they sometimes, there's a mantra, prisoners are just people who got caught. But all of us could be there. And or many of us could be there. And so they're real people. And it drives me crazy when I hear, for instance, it said that a double murderer, well, he's more than a double murderer. He's a whole lot of other things besides a double murderer. But we label these things and we don't take time to say there's more here. And it puts us at a relationship that is more at peace with one another. I have a classmate, Father Hugh Hines, who is now in Boston, but he's one of my inspirations, and there's a lot of them, for people who have less and remembering them and not forgetting them, because our society, you know, what's his name, talks about the invisible man. And a lot of people are invisible to some of us because they're not our status, they're not our class, whatever. And Father Hugh was just telling me the last time I talked to him, and it just came out accidentally. He said that in Boston he gets $300 a month, and sort of his spending money or whatever. And then he started to tell me that he's been for years sending $35 to a man at Sing Sing prison who's a lifer now. And he says now he's getting old. And he said he, with that money, every Friday buys himself a chicken dinner. And, you know, it was rather emotional to think about that. Here's a person who's in prison for life, and his treat is a chicken dinner on Friday night with the money Father Hugh sends him. And then he goes on to tell me that there's a lady from Trinidad in New York City near 96th Street where our parish is. She's 81 years old. She, in a one-bedroom apartment, is raising two great-grandchildren. And so he sends her $100 every month. So, you know, all I'm saying is he keeps reminding me that there are folks out there, and when I'm spend the old money for David because he has these book desires, maybe maybe I should be thinking more about these other things, you see. This is experiential, but my most life-changing experience in relationship to a society was going to Tennessee State University in Nashville in 1974. And at that time, it was the university campus ministry was, I'd say, 95% black and probably 90% African-American black. And then there were the wee token white people who were there to get federal funds and so on, because you had to have a certain amount of integration and so on. But I had never, well, it was life-changing in two ways. I had never been in the South before, and that is like going to another country, you know. At least we Northerners think that's the way it is. And then living in and working in the African American community, and I became an apprentice and a learner about another culture and where it's coming from. And it, for a long time, I was very conscious of my whiteness in the midst of blackness. And I still remember, my goodness, Father Neil, who lined up for me before I got there, that there was to be a social with a dance to welcome students. And here I go. I said, well, how do I go? So I went in my black suit and collar, and all of these young adults, every one of them African-American, 200, 300 there, dancing and so on, and Verlina King saying to me in my black suit, Father David, come on, we're going to do the bump, which is a dance. And so here I am out there, this 39-year-old or whatever, male, white male, doing the bump with everybody else, and you talk about feeling like a fish out of water. I mean, my goodness. And so on. But and then I would go to assemblies sometimes where I'd be in the whole auditorium and they'd start talking about the white man, and this was still coming out of the civil rights movement, and the fist was still very much there and so on. And I said, gee, they're talking about me. Well, they weren't talking about me. They were talking about what a condition in our society. And slowly, slowly, you become a learner, and you begin to relate, and you begin to love what's happening. But it took a long time. I mean, because this was not only getting to know and be at peace with another community, but we're still not coming from the same position. African Americans and white Americans we're still working it out. You know, the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman thing has just brought it back to light, that we're coming from different places, and we see things differently. And I still remember, after 4 years, being at witnessing a wedding in Humboldt, Tennessee, and it was Henry and Rosalind, two African-American students, and I had their wedding. And at the reception, I'm sitting there, and Henry all of a sudden comes over, because we are always joking around. He grabs me and he says, now we gotcha. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, you're the only white man here. And I was so happy because I hadn't noticed. And that's when I knew. But you see, it took all this time, because it was more than just getting to know another, but all of this experiential thing. So it's left me today to a considerable degree, I wouldn't say a 100% degree, looking at things from an African-American perspective and an Anglo or English or white American perspective. But I feel like I'm gifted, because I can see that. Where I go with it, I don't know always. But, trying to get at peace with one another. Animating peace, a rule of life. Doing more than praying for, yes, but doing more. I have a second little piece to this, and this is this. That I was once on our Justice and Peace Directorate in our province, and we got onto this kind of division of justice and peace issues, which I very much liked, and that is to divide it up into direct service, education, and advocacy. A lot of us do direct service, helping the poor and the feeding the hungry and so on and so forth. Our local fraternity in the last few months they try to do something every month now in a kind of service way. And one month was to make sandwiches for a group. The next month was to bring plants, either flowers or vegetable plants, to Oasis Catholica, to the poor, some of the poorest among us in Athens and so on. But then they moved the next month into what I call education, because they showed a film called Sun Come Up. And it's about the world's first climate change refugees, the Carteret Islands in the South Pacific, and how because of the rise of water and so on, which is, again, it's another environmental issue, these people have had to leave their island because their island is now flooding. And so to find some other that would accept them and so on. So what they did was they showed this film after Saturday evening mass and invited the congregation. Well, they didn't get a big groundswell, but they got maybe 30 people to come and see this film and to learn about one of the issues in our world. And then they had a discussion. And I say they moved, therefore, from direct service also to a next category, and that is education. And my thesis is we don't usually advocate for change when there is injustice or lack of peace here, whatever, unless we educate ourselves, unless we teach ourselves. And one of the ways, and this is what I'd kind of like to need to get moving here. End with is I've done now, I think 9 Just Faith programs, and they are education programs, and we're on our 10th one in Athens. 3 of them Sister Joan had before I got there, but I've also done them in South Carolina in 2 different places, and I find them life changing for some people, not everybody, but. It's a 30-week program founded by Jack Jezreel in Kentucky, and it goes on in many, many dioceses in the country. But here's what I advertise it as, if I can find it, in my church bulletin this past week. Just Faith, keeping up with Pope Francis, because I think he's right there. The in-depth 30-week exercise in reading, sharing, guest speakers, immersion experiences, DVDs, and retreats that mine the biblical and church teaching on justice as it might be addressed locally, nationally, and internationally. And as Jack Jezreel says, you've got to do something in-depth. Some of us are changed by listening to our talks. Some of us are changed by reading a book. Some of us are changed by meeting a person. But I say when we do the work and we do it over time and we do it in depth, whether it's 4 years or 6 years at Tennessee State or whether it's 30 weeks with Just Faith program and so on and so forth, it moves us to action. I'll end with this little story. Father Francis Gorman in Anderson, South Carolina, was a pastor in the African-American community in very, very small, forgotten end of Anderson, if any of you have been there, and some have. But there was a chemical plant opened up right next door, and Father Francis smelled a rat. He said, I wonder if that chemical plant would open in any other part of the city. And he began to do his research, which is his education. He went to Columbia, South Carolina, repeatedly to find out what kind of chemicals they were manufacturing. And then he found out that the three or four of them were known carcinogens that would not have been allowed in any other part of the city. So with his education, over time, it took him 2 years, but he took them to court, and he got rid of the chemical plant because he said, there's no other place in this city that would have it, and we're not going to have it either. You're coming here because we're considered the weak and the forgotten, and people don't care about us, so you're going to open it here. And he won. And you say to yourself, he educated himself to the point where he did something about it, the advocacy, and something changed. So we want us to change ourselves. We want us to help change our world. Our world has too many problems.
I've known Father David for a long time, and I would just like to ask two questions, two comments. David, when you were in Greensboro, I never saw you do the bump. Why not?
I forgot how to do it.
And secondly, I was in Boston 3 times, and after hearing what Father Hugh was getting for his little stipend, I might go back there. A few weeks ago, somebody sent me an email, and it was about a particular case of theft. This lady apparently had a real problem of theft. And this whole town, because of the recession, there was a lot of thievery going on. And this lady was in court. There were a few people present, plus her husband. You can tell the judge was very, very upset. And he said, "Ma'am, I understand that you stole from the supermarket. And tell me right now, what did you steal?" Sheepishly, she said, I stole 2 cans of free cling peaches. And he said, "I want to know right now, you know, about how many peaches were in each can?" And she said, "Well, you know, there were small cans, and I counted out about maybe 6 peaches in each can." "So 2 cans? And she said, "Yes, Your Honor." "Well, I know this is bizarre, but I'm going to give you 12 days in jail because this has to stop. We have to set a lesson and an example for people." And just when we thought everything was resolved, the husband put up his hand, you know, and the judge says, "Yeah, what can I do for you, sir?" He said, "I just want to tell you, I'm the husband, and I love my wife so much, and I really think she needs a lot of help. And so I think it's important to fess up here. 2 weeks ago, she stole 2 cans of peas." For some reason, unless I'm giving my talk at a different place, I was given a little different focus. How do we live out justice and peace? What has been our involvement in various justice and peace issues? And what do we see are the challenges of the justice ministry, and where do we fall short? We talked about love in that comical joke. And then there's the issue, which is important, love, but definitely it has to be our focus. But today I want to talk about justice. It's always been my feeling for the last 20 years that there will never be peace in the world. There will never be peace in the world unless there's justice. I have to be honest, while I've given a lot of talks on justice and peace, even in the Diocese of Raleigh and so forth, I couldn't find my notes. And this was good, because This was a very, very helpful exercise for me. And Father David alluded to three things, three components of what I call social justice. But there are a number of dimensions and aspects of what is included in the whole theme or schema of social justice. I would like to ask you just for a moment, what do you think are some of those other elements that comprise or constitute social justice? I never knew seculars to be so shy. Anybody? Pardon me? Food for all people. Integration. Immigration. What are the dimensions that constitute justice? Yes. Empowerment. Sure. Empowerment. Okay. Dignity. Worth. Work. Work. Okay. Let me tell you some of the things that I wrote down. Everything you say is definitely true. I wrote down mindset conversion, a conversion of heart. Let me tell you my example of what happened to me in my life. I was ordained in 69. I don't think we had more than two classes on social justice in the seminary. Maybe Father David's experience was different. Mine was not. As a deacon in 68, I went to Boston. We probably had two to four people every day come and ask to see a priest. They wanted to see a priest basically for food, for money, basically. Homeless. I came back in 72 and was there for a number of years, and we would average three, four people every single day would come and ask for a priest. What do they want? Money for either liquor or for something else. They were homeless. I returned there. I was taken aback. They asked me to be rector of this huge, huge downtown shrine, St. Anthony Shrine. I saw a bread line of 150 people to 200 people every single day. I'm a little embarrassed by this, but it's true. I get there, I see all these homeless, disheveled people scaring the wits out of many of the people in the congregation. And immediately, for me, I'm saying, what are they doing here? What's embarrassing is because of my background, let them pick themselves up by the bootstraps. Friends, they didn't have any boots. They didn't have any straps. The Boston Globe quoted me when they came to interview me, and I said, it's the most psychologically devastated group of people I've ever seen in my life. Friends, it was a wake-up call. I couldn't believe it. It was the friar community under the leadership of myself and our lay committee of justice and peace borrowed over $1.5 million, established a day shelter. It had to be holistic. You just can't give people food. We offered counseling, medical care, clothing, shelter in the works. They are now seeing 800 to 1,000 people every single day. Because of solidarity, because of strategy, because of people coming together whose mindset was changed, there was a conversion experience. I talk about the other elements that are so necessary. That was what I call direct service. That's great. And sometimes we give ourselves accolades saying, look at what we're doing. These people would have nothing without our help and our assistance. You're right. But it can't stop there. And then there's what David talked about, the education, the formation. There's so much we need to be apprised of. There's so many things going on now, the injustices, one after another, and you can't read it all. You can't even grasp it all. But it's important that we get a smattering, that we educate ourselves in at least some arenas, some areas, so we can speak intelligently. Because I have to admit, some people do not have the good grasp, and they say things, and they're not accurate. They're myths. The fourth component of this whole social justice network has to be social analysis. And what that is we step back and we reflect and say, what's happening? Do we like what's happening? Does it need to change? If it does need to change, how can I be an instrument? How can I be a part of being a change agent in making an improvement and improving the quality of life of others? We are so busy. This is really, once again, it's a discipline. We let things go by. Look at the Industrial Revolution, what people were doing in our own country. Very few people stopped and said, I think something's wrong with this picture. Excuse the expression, but hell. There's a lot of things that are wrong with what's going on today. Do we recognize that? Do we come together to strategize in saying there has to be a change? The fifth element is experience, the experience dimension. What do I mean by that? I love Richard Rohr, I'll tell you. He's a modern-day prophet. He really is. And in one of his books, he says, you know, sometimes we can wax eloquently and we can give great sermons and talks, and other ministers can do the same. And we could read a book, and it could really touch us. It could change us a little bit. But what really changes a person and changes their heart is the experience of being there, of seeing. Since 1999, over 100 people have gone to our El Salvador ministry. We have an immersion experience there every single year, sometimes twice. And I would venture to say that almost everybody that came back said, it's changed my life. Because they experienced how people lived in the injustices that they saw. The next thing that constitutes to me social justice, and you mentioned it before, is this dialogue dimension. Some of us become so, I'm going to use a big word, apodictical. This is it. This is how it is, and I don't want to hear anything else. I know I'm right. Friends, we need to listen to one another. The conservatives need to listen to the liberals. The radicals need to listen to the conservatives. What is the point? What is the message? We never want to compromise, but sometimes we're not hearing the heart of what they're saying because we're in a defensive mode. I know one of the themes today is peace, bridging and making, building peace. It could never happen unless there's true, sincere, spiritual dialogue And then we get to the advocacy. It's really a strategy, but it's never going to work, basically, if it's only one person. It's the numbers game. It's structural changes. And they can be made. And I've seen it happen. I see it happen all the time. I see in the fifth row or the fourth row many of our secular Franciscans from our fraternity in the triad, and some over here too on my left. They go to the advocacy days almost every year in Washington, and they see their representatives on the following day. Some have never missed a year. They're being a voice for the voiceless. And of course, we can do all these wonderful things, but if it's not grounded in prayer, it's not gonna work, friends. It's not gonna work as effectively as it could and should work. And I'm convinced of that. So, in short, and even though I had other material, I'm not going to expound on that. All these dimensions, all these aspects are crucial, are essential for social justice to be implemented. For Micah's call in the Old Testament to really flourish, to work, to be reenacted. I conclude with this one story. It's always touched my life. I like a good opera, friends. And I love some of Puccini's works. I love Madame Butterfly. I like Boheme. But Turandot is probably his most famous. It's the most wonderful opera. And when he was composing this, he got very, very sickly, and he went to the doctors and everything else, and he developed cancer. And they told him he possibly would not have too much more time to live. He worked feverishly on trying to finish this opera. His family was very upset with him because he should have been resting more, but he ignored that. And it got to a point where he realized most likely it's not going to happen. So he spoke to some of his students. One of his favorite students was Toscanini. And he said, you know, if something happens, could you finish this? And one day he was rushed to the hospital, and 2 days later, he died. And so the students got together and worked feverishly to try to complete this opera. It took 2 years to complete it. I don't know if any of you have been to the La Scala Opera House in Milan. It's a magnificent place. It's the premier opera house. And opening night, it was just packed. And Toscanini was asked to conduct. And he started the opera with the music and everything else, and it was just magnificent. It was magnificent. You could hear a pin, you couldn't even hear a pin drop. It got to a point then where there was an abrupt stop. Everything stopped. There was total silence. Nobody turned around. The Toscanini did not turn around to face the audience. The audience didn't know what had happened. Toscanini turns around in tears, and he says, this is the last note that you just heard by Puccini. He turned around, still tearing, facing the orchestra, total silence, and then he started again with the music. It was magnificent. The ovation, I think, took about 15, 20 minutes at the end. And I think, and Toscanini, when he did turn around, he did say to the people, but this is where Puccini stopped. But we were asked to finish his work. And I think in our lives, as secular Franciscans, we're asked, we're urged to complete the work of justice that Christ exhorted us to do. God bless. Thank you.
Let me just take a moment of silence. Just absorb what you've just heard from our distinguished panelists. Humbly ask the Holy Spirit to rise to your awareness one thing that you heard today. That you can take and make your own. And so it is. Amen. We're going to take a 15-minute break and get some refreshments, use the facilities. Then we're going to come back, and any burning questions, burning concerns, anything that's bubbled up from what you've heard today, that you'd like to share or ask a question of our panelists. The one piece that you ask the Holy Spirit to reveal to you, how do you make that your own? Discover what it is that the Spirit is requesting of you. I think the one thread that ran through all of the talks is having that heart of peace. Choosing, remember, between stimulus and response, there's that space. And in that space, you make that choice. And in that choice is the guidance and the animation of the Spirit. And will you follow? Or will you choose to ignore? I think we've heard quite a lot today. Things that will stir within us, perhaps, especially for me, moving forward in JPEG animation. I too was on the JPEG directorate. I worked for St. Francis of Assisi Church on 31st Street. And back in 2003, the pastor asked for a JPEG animator, and nobody knew what that meant. And everybody kind of, you know, discovered a loose hangnail or piece of lint on the shirt, fly on the wall. You know, nobody wanted to do another thing. And so finally he came to me and he said, I want you to be our JPEG animator. And I said, okay, I'm going to pray about it. I didn't know what JPEG meant. I didn't know what animation meant. So Father came back to me, and I said, well, what's expected of me? And he said, at St. Francis Church, we have the advocacy, we have the direct service, but not the education. He said, I need you to educate the pew sitters, the people in the congregations. They came to Mass, but they were here. Anything out here, they knew nothing about. I need you to educate them. So I said yes. As Tom was saying, that default yes. And then, to my amazement, Father said, here are the rules. Here is your hours, and here is your salary. You're going to pay me to do this? And he said, we need it done. And I said, okay, what's an animator? And he said, well, call up our Holy Name Province animator and ask him. It was Russ Testa. So I called up Russ. Hey, Russ, how's it going? I'm the new JPEG animator here at 31st Street. Yeah, I heard. So, Russ, what's an animator? And Russ said, well... So I had to discover my own definition of animation. And we know animation as in cartoons. Right? Because anytime I told somebody I was an animator, they say, oh, that's cool, you draw cartoons. An animator gives life to something. So my definition of JPEG animator was to give life to the issues of social justice. Then inciting the people to take action. So as an animator, you bring life to the issues, whatever those issues are. And you bring life to the issues in such a way through prayer, through empathy, through compassion, through active listening, in such a way that the other will want to take action. They'll want to join you. They'll become your ally, not your opponent. This is how we're going to get the youth in. They want to belong. They want to be a part. But we're so divided because we believe we have this answer and we know what's good for them. And yet, they may have an answer. They have their own grain of truth. And it's up to us to listen.